We talk about the future of the Charlotte Hornets and who could be their next head coach. We celebrate some new members of the Hall of Fame, as well as Drew Holiday. And we respond to the unfortunate breaking news of Julius Randle's season-ending surgery. That and more coming up right now on this episode of No Cap Room. Hello, friends. Welcome to No Cap Room. My name is Jake Fisher, senior NBA reporter for Yahoo Sports. Joining me as always, senior NBA writer for Yahoo Sports, it's my man, it's your man, it's everyone's man, it's Dan Devine. What is up?
Apparently I'm having a good hair day. I found that out 5 seconds ago, so that's pretty cool for me. Thank you for letting me know that.
Yeah.
Because outside of that, I'm having a real 41-year-old ass morning, like waking up with like, why does my arm hurt? Oh, that maybe like from when you ice skated a month ago. Why does your back hurt? Oh, you ran yesterday. And like, it's a lot of stuff like that where you're like, it's April, everybody's on the injury report, but I'm on the injury report for existing as opposed to like doing things. So that's kind of a bummer. But when I find out that the hair looks right, then like that kind of, it does make everything else a little bit easier. So I appreciate that assist from you.
Look good, pod good.
That's right. And if you pod good, they pay good. There you go.
We're
just like Neon Dion.
No, Dan, for those of us who are not joining us on YouTube, and if you're not, what are you doing?
You got to get there.
Dan said that he just didn't wash the hair, ran some water through it. And that's what I've learned. You need the natural oils. If you wash it too much, too frequently, you lose the sheen. You lose the bounce, the buoyancy. So
it's just good to have this kind of validation, because the last thing that my 6-year-old said to me before she left the house this morning was, looking a lot at your forehead. And I was like, is there more of it than there used to be? Is that what's going on here? She's like, it's wrinkly. And I don't know. I'm like, all right, Jesus Christ. So like starting my day with that kind of energy, you've brought me back up, Jake. Let's go and let's talk about the goddamn NBA.
We got plenty to talk about. We have, I had a nice chat with Drew Holiday on Monday night. I'm here in Charlotte, where the Celtics blasted the Hornets in the second half after a strong effort from Bassam Micic and Davis Bertans and Grant Williams. And then, of course, the Hornets revealed that Steve Clifford will be stepping down from his head coaching duties. And I was at that press conference yesterday afternoon. Later we will talk. The highlight of my trip so far was being in the locker room after that Celtics Hornets game and watching all of the Celtics watch the final few minutes of the Iowa LSU game and just talking about Caitlin Clark and Angel Reese having smoke and all that type of stuff. So that was really cool. But yeah, let's get into the news where Steve Clifford and the new Executive Vice President of Basketball Operations in Charlotte, Jeff Peterson, met with the media yesterday at 4 p.m. Eastern inside the Spectrum Center on East 5th Street here in Charlotte. And yeah, formally announced that Cliff is going to be stepping down once the season is over. And I was waiting for the guy to cry. That's truly, and I'm like red in the face, emotional, and He said something that really stuck out to me, which was that he just wanted to be a special ed teacher who taught and coached high school basketball, and just things kept happening to him. And part of what's been, this has been like in the works for a while. Like there's been ongoing conversations between Cliff and Jeff Peterson and the new ownership group here, led by Rick Schnall and Gabe Plotkin, being that obviously this is a changeover time period, Mitch Kupchak exiting stage left, and it's just only natural to look at maybe getting a coach that fits more of the profile of the players, being that Cliff is 62 and this whole roster is 23 or younger, basically. And that being said, though, like he's just someone who is purely a teacher of the game, loves to watch film, loves to just be in the gym on the hardwood in the lab. And you could just see the care factor that I think, look, the NBA and like rising up the ranks and like whoever gets this job, whoever gets many a job, like the first chair, is in certain respects around the league a Game of Thrones type dynamic where you've got knives being thrown and throats being cut and all that type of stuff. And like Cliff really did and does embody the like purity and sanctity of like coaching is supposed to be, like leadership and mentorship and helping players grow. And all that being said is why I think he will be a valuable member, however he is in this next faction of being some type of advisor. There's no, they made it pretty clear that they do not have a specific role designed for him, and that's going to be a continued conversation. But he's going to be around, and I do think he's going to be a really valuable voice and personality moving forward, regardless of that capacity.
Yeah, I'm glad you noted the. I just expected to be a special ed teacher coach in high school. Like, that stuck out to me too. Just like the idea of, what's the John Lennon quote, right? Like, life is what happens while you're busy making other plans, and then like you look up and he spent 13 years as an assistant and like more than a decade as a head coach. You know, like it's kind of wild the way that those things can evolve. The other thing I have in my notes here is just coach ass coach. Like what you sort of draw up what a coach look in my head, and I think about what a coach looks like. And it's probably like this particular damage of having rooted for Knicks teams led by Jeff Van Gundy and Tom Thibodeau, where it's like the vision of the coach is the guy who looks like he has never slept because he is constantly grinding tape to look for the next, you know, slight thing he can help teach a player, or you know, the avenue of advantage that it can exploit in the next game. But that's like a Steve Clifford team. And there's pros and cons to this. You kind of always knew what you were getting with a Steve Clifford team, and that like they were always going to be organized. They were going to be like, get back on transition D first, clean the defensive glass, don't turn the ball over. Like the basic fundamental stuff of successful basketball, they were always going to get that right or die trying. And that was why, you know, like really also ran franchises like the post Bobcats Hornets or the post Dwight Magic. He got those teams to the playoffs. Like they didn't linger long once they were there because they were always out talented, but he got those teams to like the apex of what their ability could generate through the way he coached the game and the way he organized his team. And I think that's like one of the highest compliments you can give a coach. Like, whatever talent you gave him, he was going to get the most out of it to the best of his ability. And there was, you know, the last 2 years, I think the record is, I mean, obviously wildly underwhelming. I believe it was 45-112 to this point in his two seasons back in Charlotte. But he never had a team. You know, like LaMelo Ball played 58 games the last two seasons. Miles Bridges was their second best player two seasons ago, missed all of last season after being arrested on felony domestic violence charges. And Gordon Hayward missed huge chunks of time. Mark Williams missed huge chunks of time. They traded Terry Rozier, you know, midway through this season. The complete miss and like no, like absolute cipher of a 2021 draft that got you James Booknight and Kai Jones, where like a couple of picks around them, it's Alperen Şengün, Trey Murphy, and Jalen Johnson. Like every franchise has those misses, but like he just never had a team to coach. And he still, like, there was that moment of after the trade deadline this year, when they move PJ Washington, they move Gordon Hayward after they've moved Terry Rozier, and all of a sudden the Hornets are like a top five defense for 2 weeks. And you're like, that's Steve, right? Steve Clifford will take the ramshackle mismatched parts of whatever you give him, and he'll give you a top 10 defense just by not screwing up the small stuff. And so whatever happens next, you're right. Like whatever the culture is that Charlotte wants to build, whatever version of the team, whatever form the team wants to take moving forward, if you can bring a little of that, like, sweat the details, nail the small stuff, and then the big stuff can happen thereafter. Like it gives you a basis and a foundation for growing. And you know, you shouldn't throw out the baby with the bathwater there. Like I totally understand you want a new look moving forward. You know, many other franchises that have had their, you know, their Mark Daigneault, or, you know, in Washington, where maybe Brian Keefe gets that look for the way he's organized that team. Like young guy gets his roadmap for sure. Joe Mazzulla in Boston, Brad Stevens before that, et cetera. If that coach can have a little bit of what Steve Clifford's brought in him, I think that would probably serve the franchise in good stead.
Yeah, the natural question is why do it now? Why announce this now with seven games left? And to your point, I think that, and Jeff Peterson confirmed as such in the press availability, there's already, and you know, Peterson came from Brooklyn where they let go of Jacque Vaughn and have absolutely been making inroads on trying to collect intel and figure out which coaches to be interviewing. Washington's going to have a search as well. Like, those are already three teams that are at least in the same type of mold of rebuilding, whatever word you want to call it, that from my understanding, I mean, we're going to have more of this tomorrow on Yahoo Sports Friday. I'm going to put together a coaching notebook of sorts. Like, there's going to be some steep competition, I think, for these young first-time head coach assistant type guys. I mean, Jordy Fernandez, for one, the associate, I think that's his title in Sacramento, who was the head coach of Canada this past summer that took the Canadian national team to the bronze medal past Team USA, the first medal since 1936 for Canada. That guy is going to be, without a doubt, getting a job this year. There's plenty of other young coaches to keep an eye on. I mean, I saw Chris Mannix at Sports Illustrated mention Charles Lee as a strong candidate for this position here. And there's definite connections between him and Peterson and the ownership group from his time in Atlanta back when they were all involved in that organization. So there'll be names to watch, but I think just like the trade deadline, the coaching market functions kind of similarly in that certain teams are going to have certain wishes and they're going to overlap, and whichever thing happens first will impact the other, and it's a domino effect and what have you. So I think there will kind of be this interesting waves of the cycle too, where you're going to have these teams who are out of the playoffs already starting to try to make this happen. And then, as we've talked about time and again on the show, there are going to be postseason casualties. There's going to be a Mike Budenholzer and Nick Nurse and Frank Vogel and what have you. Like there's going to be established.
There could be.
There's going to be. There's going to be. Without a doubt.
Okay.
Without a doubt. There's
reporter
two,
man throwing it down. I respect it.
100%, man. Like, there are too many teams that have real expectations that mathematically, they are not going to make it there. Like, there's only four teams in the West who can make the second round. And there's like nine teams in the West who think they should make the second round. And the nature of the business is that the coaches are the ones who get the axe when those things happen. So I can't say how many, I can't say where, but yeah, I'm sticking to it definitively. There's going to be at least one coach who's let go based off of to various degrees. You know, if certain teams make the conference finals and don't make the finals, that just might not be enough. So it's going to be interesting to see how all that unfolds. But let's save some more of that for the notebook on Friday. And let's get into our Hall of Fame news, where Chauncey Billups was also here in Charlotte yesterday. And the guy was glowing, man. He walked into that little dinky photo room where there's probably like 11 seats and sat down in front of that Blazers backdrop and had just an absolute grin on his face. And when people first started asking him about it, he like seemed truly, genuinely humbled and honored, which was kind of a cool moment for me personally, being that, as we've talked about this on the show, I'm like so anti awards culture and like, why does the Hall of Fame even exist? Why do we need to tell these people who already made millions of dollars and have been enshrined in their local cultures that, like, oh yeah, you're gonna have your head in bronze in some random place outside of Boston that like no one really goes to, and there's like one restaurant across the street off the highway.
Why all this slander for Springfield, Massachusetts? It's done nothing to you.
I went there one time with my AAU team, and we did not play well in the tournament because we had too much fun at the Hall of Fame. So maybe that's what it is.
Maybe that's what it is.
Also, I remember that gym being, I forget what high school it was, some high school in Springfield, Mass, and there was no air conditioning. That was the most I've ever sweat in my life until this summer when I did one hike in Vietnam and I couldn't open my phone because my hands were too perspired, whatever the word would be. But yeah, Chauncey Billups, I don't know, our producer John Gennaro before we came on the show was kind of like, is he worthy of the Hall of Fame? I don't know where the line is, but the guy seemed genuinely pleased. Similar to Steve Clifford, he was like, my dream was only really to like make the NBA. I never really thought anything more than that. So the fact that this has come is pretty cool. Vince Carter also named to the Hall of Fame as well. He has a much different resume, but I'm going to stop talking and let the ball go to my podcast partner here. Dan, any thoughts on this early Hall of Fame news?
Well, I mean, Chauncey Billups, much more of a pass-first point guard than my host on this program. we're pounding the rock here. No, Chauncey Billups is going to be a really interesting conversational case. Because the statistical resume is not overwhelming, right? Like the individual, like how many points he scored, how many assists he generated, all that kind of stuff. Like I haven't done the Basketball Reference, you know, stat dive. I normally do that. I did it for Vince Carter. I didn't have time this morning on Chauncey, but he was the best player on a championship team. He was a finals MVP. He was the best player on Pistons teams that made six straight conference finals. He was a five-time All-Star and a three-time All-NBA selection. Like, you could make a reasonable argument that he was maybe the second or third best point guard of that decade of the 2000s, if you put Nash up ahead of him because he won, you know, from the MVPs. But in terms of the impact he had on winning teams and the postseason success of those teams in Detroit and then also in Denver, you know, they had that sort of second chapter to his All-Star level career before, you know, later in his career starts getting injured. But even then, he's playing like reasonable roles on good teams in with the Clippers too. Like, he was a player of consequence on teams that mattered for a long time and even was a contributor past his prime. And so that, I think it's interesting. It'll be interesting to see how that sort of stacks up. Although you never thought of Chauncey Billups as like the best player in the league, or like, you know, maybe like an all-NBA first team caliber player, you kind of can't tell the story of what that decade of basketball was without the teams he was a big part of. And then he also was like, he was the leader of a team that was within one win of a repeat, like two straight championships. So that's interesting. And to your broader point of why do we have the Hall of Fame? I know you're being facetious and you're kind of, it's like an extent.
I'm really not.
Well, okay. Well, if you're not, then the answer is because that is a museum to teach people about the history of the game.
Yes.
And to celebrate its greatest participants, but also like these are museums. That's what Halls of Fame are.
For sure.
And so that's why, I mean, Chauncey Billups, his role in that, you know, reasonable people can disagree about it. And where he, you know, like stacks up against, you know, he's not LeBron James or whatever, right? But like, does he deserve or merit inclusion in that museum of like, this is how we tell the story of the game? There's a pretty reasonable argument for that. Vince Carter, I think that's maybe the stronger point in his favor than even the statistical resume, which he's one of 66 players in history to make 8 All-Star teams. All the rest of them are in the Hall of Fame, except for the ones that are currently playing or recently retired, rather, Dwight, Carmelo Anthony, and then also Larry Faust, who played in the 50s. I can't speak intelligently about Larry Faust's game, but the
Larry Faust got robbed, man.
Listen, people forget he was a problem. He was a bucket. Vince is one of 15 players ever with more than 25,000 points, 6,000 rebounds, and 4,000 assists. 11 of them are already in. The other 3 are LeBron James, Kevin Durant, and Russell Westbrook, so they will be as well. Again, you get to that point of like, was Vince the best player in the league? I get, you know, you could maybe make that argument at some point, you know, in the early part of his career in Toronto. He never advanced further than, you know, as the leader of the team. You know, there was that one series, famously, he leaves against the Sixers to go graduate from UNC, comes back the day of Game 7. They lose that series. The Sixers wind up going on to the NBA Finals. Vince was never the leader of a team like that. The way he left out of Toronto was...
That was my childhood, a lot of man. That was feeling. It right there.
Yeah, all these sort of... Like, so there's a lot to pick through in the narrative strands of it. But I think, you know, you mentioned Jordy Fernandez being the head coach of the Canadian national team that is like this golden generation of Canadian talent. It's not as simple as you draw a line from Vince Carter being a Raptor to this generation of players, but it's not that simple. Like, all of these guys get into the NBA and get into basketball and get into, you know, competing at the highest level because of what Vince Carter did as like an elevator of like an ambassador for NBA basketball to Toronto. You can't tell the story of basketball in Canada without Vince Carter. And if the Canadian program is going to be, you know, among the best in the world moving forward. That's huge. And you can't tell the story of the last, you know, 20 odd years of the NBA without the best dunk contest performance of all time. So like those things in a museum context, I think, like, yeah, you can't tell the story of the game without Vince Carter. And so that's, I think that's the part where statistical resumes and was this guy actually the best? And would you put him on a level with Larry Bird? Like, yeah, no. But if you have like sort of an expansionist view of what these storytelling devices are, I think there's probably room in the house for both those guys, even if it's maybe on a different floor.
Only guy to play in the NBA over four different decades. I think the coolest, this is not why he's in the Hall of Fame, but I think the coolest thing about Vince is that he was able to do pretty much what every all-star scorer guy never did.
Yeah.
Is have this second run of being a complimentary piece. And some of my favorite stories I've ever written back at Sports Illustrated, when I talked to Dirk and Vince about what they physically had to do to play at 40 when they're dealing with the bad back and the weird elbow that you deal with every day. Those guys were playing in the fucking league.
Man, I'll tell you what, you know, I think there's a lot of ways in which I'm very similar to Dirk Nowitzki and Vince Carter, you know, dead eye accuracy, explosive vertical leaping. But really, that's it. Just knowing what it takes to play at the highest level. As you get up into your 40s, I salute that. I always think about, shouts out to Steve McPherson, who now I don't know what Steve does professionally, but for a long time he did write about the NBA. Mm-hmm. Very good guy. He wrote, did like a got Vince for a minute for the New York Times when they had the Off the Dribble blog there, and asked him about dunking as he gets older. And he's like, getting up isn't the problem. It's the landings that are a problem. Like,
yeah.
The landings hurt. And as I always think about that, but you're absolutely right. Like we saw Carmelo Anthony struggle with it. We saw Russell Westbrook struggle with it. Like every superstar gets to the point where they're like, they have to accept that they are not the centerpiece of everything and they have to find a way to contribute. He did that more gracefully than maybe anybody who ever reached that level. So yeah, shouts out to him.
The New Orleans Pelicans are not sticking the landing of the regular season right now. Continue to Pelican, man. Pelican's going to Pelican. After some momentous wins, they have now lost three straight after last night's game against Orlando. These are kind of two teams heading in different directions at the current moment. But then again, New Orleans is a team that could put together three straight games where we're like, oh, the Pelicans, the biggest problem in the West?
Yes.
So that's kind of been their story all year long. I'm curious, as someone who's about to watch the Magic in person tomorrow here in Charlotte, what is the secret sauce that is coming out of Magic Kingdom right now? What do you think is the recipe behind Orlando really threatening to steal the three seed from Cleveland, who just, as we've talked about, cannot have any luck or fortune in terms of injuries at all? The Cavs are just, they've been, I don't know, they need some type of shamrock or rabbit's foot or whatever to just combat all the juju going on there.
I think with the Magic, I mean, the recipe starts on the defensive end. You know, we talked about that before. It's no secret. Jamal Mosley has gotten that team, like one of the younger teams in the league, to buy in and execute an extraordinarily high level since for more than a year and a half now. Like, this is not a fluke of, you know, well, they catch these teams on the wrong night. Like, they're the reason those teams have those wrong nights, because they, like, the way it makes sense in my head, well, first off, everybody's big. Like, even their guards that are small play big. Their power forwards play like guards and their guards play like power forwards. Like, the way Cole Anthony attacks the glass, the way Jalen Suggs attacks everything. And they're so physical at the point of attack. Even their, like, more quote-unquote finesse bigs in Paolo Banchero and Franz Wagner are friggin' huge, and they don't have one elite center, but Wendell Carter Jr. is big and physical and can play it, you know, can protect the rim and clean the glass. You know, Gogo Batate, when they had him, you know, on the floor earlier in the season, was a real mean streak in the middle and a good rim protector, physical rebounder. Mo Wagner, if he is nothing else, he is physical, and he gets in everybody's head and in their way and under their skin. And they just pound you. The secret sauce of late, though, so that's their baseline. That's their table stakes. That defense is showing up every night. Oh, and you can't mention that without mentioning Jonathan Isaac, who has like, when before his injuries, it was like, well, this is the only guy that I would want to guard like Giannis or KD. Like, he is somehow able to envelop guys that big, that quick, that strong. After the injuries, is he going to be able to get back to that point? The answer is yes. Like, on a permanent basis, he's been arguably the best defender or the most disruptive defender in the league. He's just not going to play enough minutes to qualify for stuff, or enough games to qualify for all defense. But like, he is playing at a defensive player of the year level right now off the bench on a team that is one of the best defenses in the league. So they do not give you any respite on the defensive end. So there's that. They have actually been about average or better on offense for like 2 months now. Since the trade deadline, according to Cleaning the Glass, which strips out garbage time possessions, 16th in offensive efficiency, 10th in half court offensive efficiency, and I believe it's 8th in 3-point accuracy in that span. So like, if they can score, and we talked about how they generate those shots, like more Paolo Banchero playmaking out of the post, guys getting more comfortable with the way that they, you know, where they need to sort of move to hunt shots and relocate, all that kind of stuff. If they can score, they're going to be a friggin' problem to deal with in a first round series, because they are going to be, they're going to make it hard for you. And the question is, can they make it easy on themselves? And they've been doing that more and more regularly of late. And that's why they're, I mean, these other teams that go through their lapses, and injuries are part of that, obviously, with Cleveland and New York, but like, they are just rock solid on the defensive end and they're getting better offensively. And that combination is really hard to deal with.
The Magic are also a half game up on the Knicks, who just announced that Julius Randle is going to be undergoing season-ending shoulder surgery.
That's happening as we are doing this podcast. Okay.
As we're doing this podcast. So I don't know. I think Orlando, I just want to say, I've been thinking this all year long. Orlando doesn't just want to like make the playoffs and pat themselves on the back. They don't have delusions of grandeur thinking that they're making the finals, but they're not going to be a team that just is happy to be there. And they could be a real party pooper for someone in the East, depending on how these matchups work out. And you know what? Let's take an ad break and regroup and then come back and vibe check the Knicks, who now might be stealing the Cleveland rabbit's foot needing injury bad luck bug that has just been a big bummer in Madison Square Garden this season. Welcome back to No Cap Room, where we are potentially mourning the New York Knicks 2023-2024 season. Could be early. Could be an OG Anunoby return. Who knows? But for now, with Julius Randle out for the rest of the year, the Knicks announcing that he'll be reevaluated in 5 months, which, do the mental math, April plus five, September, right in time for training camp, potentially. But who's to say? Of course, a lot of reporting already coming out from friend of the program, Fred Katz, our guy Ian Begley, saying that, and this was definitely the word for a while, that Randle was trying to do everything he could to avoid this. And it's something I've heard actually a lot this season with Gabe Vincent's injury in LA and Joel Embiid's situation in Philly, that like both, and different, those are knees, meniscuses compared to a shoulder, but this balance of, do we try to not go under the knife, and you can end up like sacrificing more time, hindsight being 2020, if you had just gotten the surgery earlier. But these are just difficult. I mean, it's ultimately a person deciding what to do with their body. And it's a complicated factor, but it's really unfortunate he couldn't get back out there. Of course, like, this was a team that looked like a real threat to win the Eastern Conference in that immediate aftermath of Anunoby coming from Toronto, that undefeated stretch to start. And just when Mitchell Robinson comes back and it looks like things are starting to shift in the right direction, a lot of wind taken out of the sails. So it will be, we wish Julius Randle a speedy, strong recovery. Dan, what's your initial reaction here?
My first reaction is, I know I said during the ad break I was going to be dispassionate about this. My first thought is the Kevin Garnett scene from Uncut Gems where he yells, "Why the fuck would you show me something and I can't have it?" Because that's the way I feel about having watched the OG Anunoby and Julius Randle, like the full strength Knicks in January, which is the best New York Knicks team I've watched since, I guess, they were there. It was better than the finals team that they made the finals in 2000, like since the Ewing teams, I guess, in like the mid 90s.
Wait, can I just stop you there?
Yeah, go ahead.
So Monday night, as I'm waiting to go into the Celtics locker room to talk to Drew Holiday, Patrick Ewing ambles over, sticks his hand out, shakes my hand and says, "You know if Jeff's in there?" Because Jeff Van Gundy's doing some consulting work for the Celtics. I said, "To be honest, I don't." He just shrugs. He goes, "I'm going to go see if he's in there." I'm like, of course, Patrick Ewing can go in any room he wants in the Charlotte Hornets Stadium. But also, like, the fact that he was going to find Jeff Van Gundy was just kind of a cool NBA history moment for me to be glimpsing and shaking a hand in.
Yeah, spiritually, Patrick Ewing is always searching for Jeff Van Gundy. I mean, who among us isn't? So that's my immediate reaction is like, there was a sample. There was a version of that team that we saw that had that kind of ceiling. It's why the Knicks went kind of, not all in, but why they made big swings at the trade deadline to go get Bojan Bogdanović, to get Alec Burks, to some reinforcements for the bench, to put them in a position where they looked on paper to be like the deepest team or one of the deepest teams in the conference. And so there was, you know, Boston's the rabbit that ran out fast and no one's catching them. There was a feeling of like, I wonder what that would look like if you had the size and physicality of Isaiah Hartenstein or Mitchell Robinson with Julius Randle and OG Anunoby up front, with the way that Jalen Brunson's been playing, with the shooting and the toughness on the wing. Like, I'd like to see what it looked like, right? And we're not going to see that. And that is a frustrating thing from perspective of a Knicks fan. And also just in terms of somebody who wants to see the best possible version of this postseason that we can get. That's a bummer because it makes the quality of the matchups that we're getting reduces the potential for great series, right? That said, the Knicks still, my second thought is, there's maybe nothing more important in the conference in terms of the round one and maybe beyond than the health of OG Anunoby's elbow. There's still a version of this Knicks team that if you have OG Anunoby healthy and able to play, the inflammation goes down, he's able to comfortably shoot the ball. Like, he slots in at the four. You have, you know, next to either Hartenstein or Mitchell Robinson, you're able to use the depth on the wing that you've got, you know, with Josh Hart, with Dante DiVincenzo. You still have Deuce McBride, who's earned a bigger role off the bench. There, you know, maybe if Tibbs can come to trust Bojan Bogdanović, although Bojan needs to earn that a little bit more with some of the defensive play, but like, he's still a shooter and a sort of interesting playmaking option as a combo forward. There's still a version of that team that can win a playoff series, maybe even two, if that's depending on the matchups and depending on how things work for Jalen Brunson. But the concern was always like, you need to get Randle back so that you have somebody to run offense through when Jalen Brunson is off the floor, and to make life a little bit easier on Jalen Brunson, who looks like he has the hardest job in America most nights. And the numbers bear that out. So since January 29th was when the Randle and Anunoby injuries, when they're both out. Since that time, with Jalen Brunson on the court, and all these numbers come from NBA advanced stats, the Knicks have scored 120.5 points per 100 possessions with Brunson on the court. That is like top two offense in the league. With Jalen Brunson off the court, 101.9 points per 100 possessions, which is a level of offensive efficiency that we would more typically associate with like the process Sixers or the 7-59 Charlotte Bobcats. Like, that's, they score like that without him. And the hope was you'd get Randle back so that those minutes aren't like total tire fires where if the Knicks give up three baskets, they're down 10. And that opportunity is off the table now. So maybe knowing that and having some finality about it affords Tom Thibodeau and his staff a little more flexibility in terms of like, well, all right, we know that's not going to be an option. So what can we do? What else is up our sleeves here? And maybe they're able to find some answers now knowing that. But a team that has already, you know, they're in that dogfight for 3-4-5 with the Magic we talked about, the Cavs we talked about. If they skid, potentially in danger of even falling further than that, that's a, you know, that would be a real disheartening set of circumstances. But it puts even more on Jalen Brunson's plate, and it's not like there wasn't a whole lot on there already.
From a more macro team building perspective, it also just sucks for New York to not have this postseason run to evaluate what this team looks like before the proverbial go get a star type run that will probably happen this offseason. Not to say they're going to probably sign someone or trade someone, but the explorative talks that we will likely write about at some point in time, like, it would have been much more interesting. I mean, it's the same thing with all these teams. You know, OKC needs to have a real sample size in the playoffs before they decide what to add to this. You know, does Denver look at their young core and figure out ways to move forward with contract stuff with KCP coming up? You know, like, for the scale is very wide in that regard. But with New York in particular, this is a team that's been trying to keep climbing steadily up the mountain, and now they were ready to, like, go purchase a ticket to the lift that takes you right to the top, you know?
Nice.
Because they already have the cart and Jalen Brunson. They just need, you know, that the metaphor is running off the track now. But I was trying to think of another analogy as you were going. I really couldn't find one that made sense, because they're not like a boat that was taking on water. It's more interesting to me that, like, hearing you say, oh, getting Randall back would have been so important, particularly for the minutes where Jalen Brunson was off the floor, like, is the direct inverse of where the Knicks were when they were the four seed, when it was only Randall doing the ball handling and they needed someone like Jalen Brunson to come in and raise that floor. And every time they raise a floor, they have to go back down a couple other levels because something else arises, whether that be, you know, Mitchell Robinson getting hurt in the beginning of all this. You know, they decide to go out and get OG. And of course, that ends up, you know, all the talk began about all that backcourt. Can we find the Alec Burks, Bojan Bogdanovic solution that just hasn't been there? So, been a lot of start and stops from a team building standpoint. And
yeah, and just one more thing on Randall. So it's like, I guess maybe this is sort of hopefully threads the needle between the, you know, fan component I was talking about earlier and the analysis component. Like, you mentioned that first playoff run where they get the Hawks and he's just like defanged, and it's really takes the sting out of, or takes the shine off of the all NBA season, like a real breakthrough season for him in his career. And the Knicks wind up responding to it. You know, he has that down year after that. The Knicks as a team have a down year after that. They go get Brunson, and it's like the immediate response is, all right, well, it sort of allows him to be more of a finisher than a creator. And he plays up and again, plays at an all NBA level. And becomes one of the, like, vanishingly few guys to make two NBA teams in the last several years. Like, and all of the other ones are the guys that you look at and say, well, that's a perennial MVP candidate. That's like a Hall of Famer. And then there's Randall. He has so they say, like, oh, now you've got Brunson and you win a playoff series and you're in this position where you're going to have another run against Miami. You got a chance to maybe make the conference finals. He's hurt. He's hurt before the end of last season with the ankle injury. Comes back early in the Cavs series, isn't quite himself, re-injures himself in that Cavs series, and is not himself throughout the Heat series. Another down postseason for him, disappointing production that, again, leads people to look at it and say, well, he's just not a playoff guy. You can't trust him. You can't rely on him. And this was the opportunity, or it felt like an opportunity for him to kind of rewrite the story of who he's been in the highest leverage moments of his season and in his career. And to see a player who has worked so hard to evolve his game, to advance his game, to help elevate a franchise that had been moribund for quite some time, who made space for the incoming superstar, even after being an all-NBA guy, like, made space for Brunson to, you know, flourish. To see him not get that opportunity is just absolutely brutal. There's kind of no two ways about it. Whatever it means for the Knicks as a, you know, their postseason chances this month, into next month if they last that long. Their chances of landing a big fish, he would in many situations maybe be a big matching salary in one of those situations. And is he a less attractive candidate for that if he's coming off dramatic shoulder surgery that might take 6 months?
I think just by default he is.
Yeah, like so that is a significant issue. But it just in terms of what that player has been sort of and often like underappreciated, I think, in within New York at least, for what he has been to elevate the franchise back to a sort of competitive standard, for him to not get the opportunity to kind of rewrite that story in this postseason is a significant that I mean, that hurts. Like, and the hope is the Knicks, even if they're not able to make that big swing or find that, you know, missing piece superstar this summer, can keep what was there in January more or less together heading into next season. And you get like a real season to look at what that team might look like over the course of a full sample, because what was there was awfully intriguing. And it's a shame we're not going to get to see it again this season.
He's had to rewrite his story over and over and over again throughout his career. Remember, he got hurt like 2 minutes into his rookie season with the Lakers and shattered his leg and had to rehab that. And then before New York, he had to take a 1-year deal with New Orleans and try to showcase that he was more than just a bully ball hog kind of, basically. That was the early rap on him. So, yeah, I had a nice conversation with him at All-Star Weekend last year, or I wasn't there, but it was over Zoom during All-Star Weekend, just about how he spent like a summer training on the beach and getting his mind right, especially after the whole like thumbs down and the Knicks fans getting after him and stuff. So on a human level, was definitely rooting for the guy to get back and be in that environment. So shout out, Julius. Hope you get better soon, man. And yeah, it'll be interesting to see how, because there's been, I've talked about this with Nikola Vucevic with the Bulls last year about Lonzo Ball. And I remember it was such a theme in my reporting back during my book with the Sixers before the process with Andrew Bynum. When you have this cloud of like, will this guy return? When will this guy return? It does kind of hurt the day-to-day product, being that like you're trying to win now, but also in ways that are going to set you up for the future in the playoffs. And like Josh Hart saying recently post-game, like, I'm of the mind that like these guys just aren't going to come back and we're going to be pleasantly surprised if they do. It's tough for certain players to have that mindset. It's easy for someone like Josh Hart, who's just going to run headfirst, full burst at any given moment on offense and defense, no matter what. But for other players who are far more dependent on being in a hierarchical structure and an offense, and you know, whether it's a movement shooter or whoever, like it is harder to kind of find that role and consistency with not knowing whether or not these guys are going to come back. So if we can give some type of silver lining here, maybe that question mark and one of the question marks and the unknowns in the equation of New York's postseason makeup being eliminated could provide some clarity that could be beneficial. But of course, you want the 2-time All-NBA and the multi-time All-Star out there. So,
yeah, right.
Speaking of 2-time All-Stars, no, I think he might even be 3. I don't know what Jrue Holiday's All-Star number is. So apologies for not fact-checking that. I spoke to Jrue on Monday, as we teased at the top here. And before we even get into that, I really do want to just highlight the being that we're in the final stages of March Madness, even though we're in April. And Derek White made that joke while all the Celtics in the road locker room here at Spectrum Center, there's really only like 2 lockers on one side and 3 or 4 on the other that are like in the short side of the rectangle. Back in my AP calculus days in high school, I would have been able to tell you exactly what that meant. But
yeah, I feel like I'm the Zach Galifianakis meme of all the numbers and things flying in front of my face. I'm like, I don't know, is that the hypotenuse? What are we talking about here?
Picture this shape. And everyone, I'm doing kind of like the Miami U for those not watching on YouTube. Everyone on that baseline was watching the end minutes of Iowa versus LSU, where Caitlin Clark went off for 40. And they were all reacting to, and like, it was just so cool to see, you know, Jaylen Brown, Derek White at one end kind of talking about, oh, like, think there's going to be smoke post game. And they were just like watching the certain moves different women made and being like, oh, like, she's got that in her bet. And they were like following the tournament. They were figuring it, like, they definitely knew like who was lined up next. And when USC came on and I was talking to Drew, he was the last guy basically in the locker room with Tatum next to him. Like, Drew was barely even looking at me. He had his eyes locked on a Juju Watkins. And it was cool to see these guys just really enwrapped in the game and talking about the tournament and the storylines and all that type of stuff. And just like fans of basketball, watching basketball and like putting respect on. And this is not to be like PC support, whatever. It really just was cool. Like you typically don't go into a locker room and there's a TV with a live game
sure.
that players are watching in general. So that alone, just to watch players reacting to other top players playing in a very pressure packed moment and recognizing the stakes and the reality that comes with it and the legacies on the line. Like the Celtics players were absolutely taken by how Caitlin Clark was bombing deep every chance she got and didn't give a shit about the ramifications of missing because she knew that's what she had to do. And just like that game recognized game, you know, the hooper mentality was on full display. It was cool to see. And especially being that like this team, they're going through the throes of this regular season where they are up 9, 10, 11, 15, 30 games on the second seed in the East.
Right.
They just got to 60. They could easily push for 65 depending on how the rest of the season goes. And it was my first time really seeing Boston up close and personal for a long while. And I'd wanted to write about Drew dating back to the beginning of the year. He was hurt or held out due to rehab or whatever when they came to New York for a preseason game. So I didn't get to talk to him. I had learned back when he was traded that he lives on an avocado farm in Southern California. And I wanted to ask him about that.
Sure.
So we got some details on Drew's 10 acres of avocados that he farms twice a year and apparently makes a pretty good profit off of. So shout out to Drew's entrepreneurial endeavors as well. But I think, you know, Cliff said this when I asked him about it in the press conference. I did not include the quote in the story, but also several coaches I talked to on background before I talked to Drew. It's just been really impressive for a guy at 34 who's essentially in a contract year before his player option, which could amount to his very last contract, is taking willingly the lowest shots of his career while taking arguably the greatest defensive workload he's ever had to do. Because in Milwaukee, which I believe his direct quote was, where I last was, where I came from, he pretty much only guarded ones and twos and was slithering over screens and fighting over screens, play after play after play. And he's talked about this previously, but you know, Joe Mazzulla sent Drew a collection of clips, of defensive clips in the early goings after that trade. And the message was like, we are going to be adaptive. We are going to do things differently. We are going to try to junk up, whether it's one possession or a whole game, by being versatile and switching up matchups and what have you. And Drew has fully embraced being this real X factor, Swiss Army knife type of guy, where at just 6'4", he's going up against Joel Embiid.
Yeah.
And he was guarding Julius Randle at times when he was on the floor and still taking Donovan Mitchell on other nights. Last night in that Thunder game with no Shea, he was all over Josh Giddey for much of that opportunity. So I just am so taken by the guy and what he's capable of doing, especially like I'm rooting to see a Milwaukee-Philly playoff series at some point, being that we have never gotten that. We've gotten plenty of Milwaukee-Boston. We've gotten plenty of Philly Boston. We have never gotten Joel Embiid versus Giannis Antetokounmpo in the playoffs. But I also really want to get a Drew Holiday Milwaukee potential revenge sure. matchup. I asked him if there'd be any extra juice to that. And he said no, because he just wants to win the title. Like, it's not going to be anything different. I don't know if that's 100% honest and candor sure. from him there, because we were talking at the very end of a 12-game road trip and he was truly the last person to get ready in the locker room. And the chutzpah wasn't exactly there, but yeah, I think that he's going to also be a very intriguing character in the postseason, being that he was the second best player on a championship team just a few years ago. He's still playing at that level. He's not in that role right now, but there may be times, and there will be times, where he's going to be called upon, or just the game is going to naturally have openings for him to rise up to that level. And I think there are a few players in the league who are that overqualified for his role right now. And that's just something I wanted to highlight.
It's a great shout, a great thing to highlight. I mean, you're absolutely right. Like, we were sort of working different parts of that. I was thinking about trying to work on something with Jrue Holiday in terms of like what that role looks like trying to put some numbers and some film to it. And I'm really interested to hear how he talked about it. I don't want to get super duper in the weeds on it, but the B-Ball Index, a wonderful website, they track all different kinds of advanced stats and all kind of different like hand tracked, visually tracked things from film. One of the things on defensive players is like a player's defensive versatility, meaning like how many positions you guard, you know, how much time you spend guarding different positions, and then also matchup difficulty, like how often you spend guarding a team's number one option, you know, high usage players, et cetera. And there's only about like 10 or 11 guys that are in the 90th percentile in both of those things, where you're like guys all across the board, every position, every size, and hardest matchups on a night-to-night basis. And Jrue is one of those guys. And to have him fill that role after they made the smart deal, like that was always a, you know, the 1-2 punch of that sort of summertime for me, where when the smart goes out, Porzingis comes in, deal happens. I know on this show, on, you know, the different, you know, reactions we had, my concern was like, well, when you get to the playoffs, are you now only going to be able to play drop coverage with Porzingis? Are you going to be less versatile at the point of attack? Are you going to be worse at the point of attack now, where you've sort of lost something with Marcus Smart? And then Jrue Holiday comes in and basically solves all of those problems immediately, while also adding a layer where it's not just he can guard up, he can play zone. He can be in the middle of the zone. He can be a matchup player. He can, you know, the kinds of switches that they do, that they were able to do even with Marcus, they can do different stuff now with him as well. Like, and he never had to do that as much in Milwaukee. And that was always one of the dings on the Coach Bud teams. Like, they are so dogmatic in their defensive strategy, and it's always drop, him slithering over the top of the screen, rear view contest, all that stuff. And then you would get to series where it's like, well, they've got to be able to switch here, but they just didn't do it enough. But Jrue can do that, right? He can sort of play any of those positions. You can't back him down and mash him unless you're like a real big or a really good big. But also, we saw earlier in the season when they first tried that out, him guarding Embiid. Embiid tries to back him down from, you know, 20 feet out. His hands are in the passing lane. He's knifing into the dribble. He's going to make that difficult too. So for someone to not only handle all of those different defensive responsibilities on what is one of, if not the most versatile defensive schemes, or diverse rather, defensive schemes in the league. And then you mentioned it's not just that his shots are lower than ever. It's like touches are down, pick and roll usage is down. Like all of these sorts of things you do, like not as many shots at the rim. He's spending way more time spotting up in the corner, not getting to isolate as often. He's having to cut off the ball more to get involved. Like the way he's used in that offense is so different than he's ever been used before. And for that to say like, yeah, I don't care. That's fine. It helps me win. It helps us get us closer. And then, yeah, maybe helps me stick it to the guys that threw me over the side to get in the new point guard over there. Like there's something to be said for that. One thing I'm going to be watching, and I'm sure plenty of people are going to be watching come the postseason, is just Jrue Holiday is in Milwaukee was a 39.5% 3-point shooter during the regular season, and a 30.4% 3-point shooter in the playoffs. And it's something Frank Madden talked about when we had him on to talk about the Bucks on Divine Intervention on Tuesday. Like the reason they felt compelled to go make that upgrade offensively was you couldn't have Jrue kind of turning back into a pumpkin again. They needed another proven shot maker, late game option, someone that they could feel confident in taking and making big shots in crunch time in the playoffs. And they'd kind of seen Jrue fall off multiple postseasons in a row, even during the title season. offensively. Can he sort of reverse that trend in Boston? Is it not as much of a big deal because of the role he plays and the reduced usage he has to sort of assume? I don't know. I think that'll be interesting to watch, but that's the bet that the Celtics are making. Like, we don't need you to be Damian Lillard on our team. We need you to be the player you've been in this role, and he has been absolutely lights out in that role so far.
43.5% career high so far in the regular season, to your point.
Yeah. So if you drop off 9%, you're still right around league average. So yeah, that's, I mean, like maybe that's all right. Maybe that's enough. And maybe the drop off wouldn't even be as stark because what's being asked of him is different. I mean, there's a lot of variables. I'm going to be interested to see how it plays out. But that was like the only ding you could have on him was like the shot making went downhill. And so the turnovers went up a little bit in the playoffs. And on a team where you needed your point guard to be assuming more of that role in Boston, like if that starts happening, all right, then more Derek White, more Jason Tatum, more Jaylen Brown. Like,
bring Sam Hauser off the bench, baby. He'll let it fly.
Peyton Pritchard, you know, let's go.
There we go. That's all we've got for you today. So we are going to go as well. Thanks to super producer John DeNiro for doing all the things he does to make the show look and sound great. Subscribe to Ball Don't Lie on YouTube or whatever podcast platform you're currently listening on. And please leave us a 5-star review. We thank you for listening. We'd appreciate it if you came back again next week for another episode of No Cap Room.